Amazon.com, where he developed, for example, the predictive models of customer behavior and applied them to marketing. That means he is really one of the masterminds of Amazon's recommender system. You all know this tool provides every customer with further suggestions of books, music titles that might be interesting for them. Besides teaching at Stanford, Andreas Weigand owns today a consulting company, and he is working, I think, with more or less all big data-intensive organizations, creating products and strategy based on metrics and behavioral analytics. Andreas, we are very interested to see your presentation. Welcome here to our meeting. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you very much for inviting me. Ladies and gentlemen, it's a pleasure to be here. And the title of my talk might be the most complicated title of the entire conference. It's called Participation, Interaction, and Discovery in the Networked Attention Economy. I promise that at the end of the talk, you'll have some idea what I was talking about. Let's start a little bit with the historical perspective. And I would like to go back 10 years and 20 years into the past in order to understand where we are right now, and then in order to give you some examples of what I think we might be going to. 10 years ago was about the time when Netscape had its IPO. It was a read-only web which we created. A web where you could follow links, but a web where you couldn't really contribute to. You couldn't write to it. We talked about consumers being part of that web. 2006, and I will give you some examples of that, is a read-write web where people have become producers. People have become co-creators. 10 years ago, in order to have customers, the key idea was to keep an as high barrier of exit. Once you have somebody, make it really difficult for them to get out of it. Now, the paradigm is to have an as low as barrier of entry. To make it as easy as possible for people to participate. That's one of the paradigm shifts. Make it easier for people to come, and if they want to leave, well, they can leave. 10 years ago, we used to talk about taxonomies. You might know that Yahoo started in order to be a directory structure which was manually populated by so-called surfers. Now, tongue-in-cheek, we call it a tagsonomy because tags are little buttons, little labels you can put on websites, pictures, basically on anything. 1996 was still a time where we worked very hard to pretest and to validate marketing strategies. Now, in this sometimes called live web, it's much more launch and learn. Sometimes we call it permanent beta. Flickr, for instance, one of the services where you can upload your pictures, used to launch a new version every 30 minutes. And even for Amazon.com, you have no idea, and I don't either, which version Amazon.com is running. So it's very different from shipping software to basically having a live web. Couple of more differentiations between 96 and 2006. 96 was a static web where the metaphors were spatial, like a link. 2006 is a live web where the metaphors are temporal. For instance, a blog lives in the time. Time has become the ordering parameter. Finally, the last two entries here are closer to marketing. Going back 20 years ago, people had, as you all know, broadcasts. It was a push medium, newsletters went out. There was some attempt to target according to the groups you try to reach, but not all that much. We moved from that targeted approach to a discovery-based approach, trying to figure out how can we have people discover stuff. has become a very, very important question on the web. Discovery 10 years ago was based on hyperlinks, those things the companies in control put onto their websites, and all you could was click or not click those hyperlinks. Discovery now is often based on social relations, people who you trust, people who have a high reputation, as well as metadata, data about objects, music, films, which are created by other humans. So discovery really has become, I think, an important element in marketing. And then finally, I just learned last night that as opposed to the more supply-driven idea, we now have much more demand-driven idea. Zara, the Spanish manufacturer, I was told, is able to produce a dress Madonna might have worn in a concert within 10 days and have it in the shops in Spain. That's a quite different world. That's what we mean by discovery and by demand-driven. So if I want you to remember one thing of this talk, then it is this simple diagram, which is my simple rendering of this paradigm shift. This is the world of 10 years ago, where a few decide of the meaning, those few on top of this pyramid. This could be the Académie Française or the Duden Redaktion or, you know, people who decide on what things are. That pyramid is turning upside down. So it's no longer the few, but it is really the masses. Sometimes it's called the wisdom of the crowds. And we should try to understand when it's the wisdom of the crowds and when it is the stupidity of the masses which determines all what's happening. So that's what I want to tell you in the next 40 minutes. But since in my introduction I was asked, you know, I was mentioned about recommendations, let me tell you a little bit about the first element, namely architectures of experimentation, before I go to architectures of participation and then to architectures of interaction. Now, I apologize also, some of the slides have some Chinese characters. I don't speak Chinese, I don't read Chinese, but I sometimes give lectures in China, and so please just ignore them. I think it's easy for most of us. So what happens when a customer comes to Amazon.com and say pushes this button, add to shopping cart? Well, of course, the page which we are constructing has to have that shopping cart in it, and there needs to be a button, proceed to checkout. But Amazon makes a 2-digit percentage of its sales by things people don't know to look for, but things people discover. And these are called, as you know, recommendations. And recommendations come in two flavors. They come in compliments, Komplementaritätsgüter, things you buy in addition to something. And that is often labeled as customers who bought X also bought Y. And they come as substitutes, Substitutionsgüter, as things which you buy instead of something else. Now, those are labeled customers shop for something, also shop for something else. Of course, as you know, Amazon doesn't employ people who try to figure out what you should buy instead of something else or what you should buy in addition to something else, but that's all generated from consumers' data. Basically, Amazon.com keeps a few large matrices, about 10 million items times 10 million items. And if you click on one item and within a day click on another item, that cell gets incremented. And then all what's happening is when you're coming to the site, it reads out the matrix of those millions and millions of customers before you and presents recommendations to you. So in that sense, from the very beginning, Amazon leveraged customer data, which they left there because, well, what else would they do but click on items and buy items in order to help other customers discover things? But I want to start with something very simple here. for architectures of experimentation. And I have a question for you. We just constructed this page where on the right-hand side I have the shopping cart and the left-hand side I have the recommendations. Or should it be this way around? That on the left-hand side I have the shopping cart and the right-hand side the recommendations. What do you think? Who thinks it should be the right-hand side? Okay, that's about half of the people. And who thinks it should be the left-hand side? That's about the other half of the people. So how do we resolve such a question? I mean, it can't be on both sides. You know, we have to make some decision. So the secret behind the success of the companies like Amazon.com, Google, eBay, etc., is that both gets built and gets tested on the live customer in the freien Wildbahn, as we say so nicely in German. So what you do is you show half of the customers, say those who have an even customer ID, one side, and the other half of the customers, those with an odd customer ID, the other side, and then you just measure what you get. And it turns out, if you define a symmetric conversion rate as well as order size, that indeed having it on the right is about 1% on the left. So the first half of you was correct. The lesson I want you to take from this is what matters is not who is right or who is wrong, but to be creative, to come up with lots of ideas, and to have an architecture which allows you to test these things with very, very little overhead. At any given point in time, Amazon is probably testing about 100 such things. So that was the first part of my talk, to talk about architectures of experimentation. The second one is to talk about architectures of participation. And I want to start here with one example from a website called Flickr. So this is the last picture I uploaded in Flickr, and a friend of mine, a filmmaker in Los Angeles, and what I want to point out here is that there are tags. So that's concrete an example of tags. It's his name, I put in the month, and I put in Los Angeles. Other people can also tag. So if you feel that other things should be added, you can just simply sign up for a free account, or just sign in if you have one already, and add your comments and add your tags. So I decide to tag something for my own benefit, so if I want to find pictures of him, I can easily find them. But the world at large is invited to also tag in a co-creation process that content which I've put up. So let's, for example, have a look at BMW. And let's see what's coming up for BMW. So this is now live here, and it turns out that 32,757 pictures have been tagged with the tag BMW. And I just invite you to explore those, to see what kind of pictures they are. For instance, this one might not be in all that good shape anymore. And as you can see, people leave comments. And I don't know any of these people. I just looked about it today. But that's an interesting discourse which is going on about, in this case, BMWs. Some of these pictures are actually amazing. If you go for the newest ones, they're just from today, from some race, I think, in Canada. So it's pretty amazing how recent this is. Here are the tags. These are sets people create, and a long list of posts where people comment on the pictures of other people. By the way, if you have any questions on the way, do feel free to interrupt me. So Flickr says it is the eyes of the world. It wants to be the eyes of the world. It wants the world to discover things. It wants the world to discover also products. And in some way you can think about it has to be part of your brand strategy It has to be part of your brand management. What do people say about your brand? Flickr also views itself of having moved from an event-based photography to an ambient photography to a photo stream where you just take pictures as you move through the world. And if you look at tags like Lebanon, you will see really amazing pictures. And that's why people, I think, came up with the term Flickr as the eyes of the world. Okay, so how do we get to attention? We could say clicks, this Web 1.0 thing from 10 years ago, clicks only allow you to click on something which actually is in a hyperlink. So you don't have much of a choice. There's not much attention going in besides the question to click or not to click. More powerful for clicks is to express your intention. I sometimes say that Google embodies the intention economy. It's about $100 billion market capitalization. But in search, you only express your intention. It doesn't depend on the result. You enter BMW and you get what you get. So the real power, the real leverage is to leverage the attention. And an example of leverage attention is to allow people to tag things. Why do people tag things? Well, I think they want to remember, they want to share, and they also want to discover. So the second example after Flickr I want to give you is an example of a website called Delicious. Delicious is a company which started about 1.5 years ago. Joshua Schachter, a friend of mine, started it and was acquired by Yahoo in December last year. So a short lifetime, but a not unprofitable one for the CEO. So what Delicious does, it allows you to tag websites. So you can tag any URL, any website, with anything you want to tag. I invite you, I just checked it out today, to see how do people tag Bertelsmann.de? How do people tag BMW? How do people tag shopadidas.com? That gives you a feeling about what the meaning of those terms are for people who feel like, you know, adding something or to remember it, to share it, and to let others discover it. There's a virtuous cycle in tagging that primarily you do it for yourself because you can't remember that site, so you just tag it, you add it, if you will, like a bookmark to your own list. But then the power comes by sharing this, by letting the world know what your tags are and by letting the world discover of what you have discovered. Let me give you an example here. And as example, I want to go and see who tags Weigand.com. So Weigand.com is my little webpage, and it turns out that 44 people have tagged Weigand.com. And now, how does discovery in this attention world live? Here's some person called UltraCare. I don't know who he is, who she is, who has seen me in Sandra Maischberger's show earlier this year. So I presume the person speaks German. And let's see what else is he interested in. Well, 41 minutes ago, he just tagged something in politics. But then also here, he had Universal Music to offer free downloads, an article from the Los Angeles Times. So in some way, let's contrast Web 1.0 discovery, which was Amazon, to Web 2.0 discovery, which is attention-based. The old people bought X, also bought Y, is statistical method. You need to accumulate enough statistics in order to be able to actually make a recommendation. It takes out the individual. Here, we have an individual who discovers certain things and I just benefit from his work of tagging the world. And who knows, Maybe hundreds of people follow the little breadcrumbs he's leaving for himself, the little sights he's tagging as he goes through the universe. That is what I mean by read, write, web. So to show you, actually, there are three kinds of discovery going on here. One is the discovery of the tag, where I can follow a topic. For instance, here in this example is I can follow the topic maps and see what other sites are tagged with maps. The second one is what I just showed you here with UltraCare, that I follow a user and discover what UltraCare is interested in. And the third one is that I can discover all the users who are interested in BMW, or in Bertelsmann, or in Vaigen.com. So that's all possible only because we have a web where we can read and write, and nothing needs to be installed in your computer. You just put on some website, in this case Delicious, whatever you think about it. Sometimes we say that tags are distilled attention, or attention pure. And that's very, very powerful. If you think about it, you have those 10 million people on the top of the triangle here, and you can extract from them what they're focused on as they're focused on it. So sometimes there's not only Delicious as example web pages or Flickr as example photos, but people do lots of tagging of other things. I invite you to check out sometime 43things.com, which has a website where people tag their goals. And more close to you here, if you think about music, a company I co-founded in 1999, Mood Logic characterized songs by getting people to provide metadata about those songs. Mood Logic was sold this year to AMG. And within a couple of years, we had 1 billion explicit ratings for songs. I would have never thought that with a little website and a couple of people, we can create what some people thought at the time were the best metadata about music by simply letting people do what they want to do. We paid almost nobody there. People just did it because they wanted to express themselves. They wanted to share. Another example here is MusicStrands, a company which started last year. There are a whole bunch of companies in the music space now which all try to get people to express themselves in order to make search easier and to enable discovery in music. Okay. In the next part, I want to relatively quickly traverse the different levels of customer behavior in order to emphasize the social aspects of the customers, namely the so-called customer network value. So in this graph, at the bottom level, I have an individual page on the web. I aggregate pages to a visit. A visit is a sequence of pages. I aggregate the visit to a customer, a customer sequence of visits, and I aggregate customers up to the network. In each of those levels, we have very different marketing opportunities. On the page, we can understand what the content is about and then show corresponding ads. And Google's AdSense shows us how to do that very well. But actually, what does it mean to do it very well for Google? Turns out that people click on average less than 1 in 100 times. So I have to confess, if I go to my local, let's say, library, and the librarian recommends a book to me and the book to me and the book to me, and I check out less than 1 in 100 times, I don't think I would be very happy with her. So the performance of Google's AdSense still leaves a lot to be desired. But still, this is what we have. More promising, then the level of the individual page is to understand how we can use the visit of the customer for marketing. This is where a big paradigm shift is happening. At Amazon.com, I spend a lot of work trying to model the modalities of the visit. What's the intention the user has? What situation is he in? What mode or what modality is he in? And we call this session-based marketing, or sometimes also occasionalization. What's the occasion which we try to capture? Here are some examples of these modalities of a visit. The third level is that of the customer, and that's a level you are very familiar with if you think of the club, where based on demographics and also based on past behavior, we try to do personalization-based marketing. Now, let me make a contrast here, and let me talk about the spectrum of information which is available in marketing. On the one end, you have demographics, which companies like Avarto are very, very good in exploiting in traditional database marketing. Somewhere in the middle, we have the past behavior of that individual, and on the web, that means if we have the individual logging in, we can get it really well. If we have cookies, it might be okay. So we have some idea of how can we extract customer signatures out of his or her behavior online. And then on the other extreme, you just have the current intentions, the current situation, the modalities. That could be, for instance, what's the time of the day? People 2 o'clock in the morning tend to have very different behavior than 2 o'clock in the afternoon. It might depend on the speed of the connection they have, etc. Traditionally, I think many people believe that it is the past behavior which is the most predictive element for marketing. What I found at Amazon.com is if I just compare two elements, namely the past behavior alone and the current intentions and modalities as we computed them from the clickstream, that actually the current intentions were more powerful to predict of what we should show to a person in order for them to buy it. On average, people buy 4 times a year from Amazon. So there isn't all that much in terms of past behavior. But in the current situation, where do they come from? That's another piece of information you have on the web. If you exploit those well, and there's a company which actually sells a product which does that called CleverSet, you would be surprised, I think, how big the difference is to the more traditional past behavior marketing. On the top level, we have the network of customers where we apply social network research. And the only point I want to make here is that when we talk about customer network value, we typically mean the intrinsic value, meaning how many euros I'm going to get out of your pocket. But for many of us, our customer network value is more powerful than only our intrinsic value, meaning how much can we influence others to shop at Amazon.com, to buy BMWs, or to go to Bertelsmann. We ran one project at Amazon to understand the customer network value, and that was called the Share the Love program. If I buy a book, after I've checked out, I get an offer and saying, hey, if you have some friends who also might be interested in that book, why don't you give us the email addresses? And we'll notify them, and if at least one of them buys the same book you just bought within a week, we give you 10% credit. They get it for 10% discount, and you know, Amazon sold another book and might even have acquired another customer for cheap. That's an example of this incentive engineering, how we get people to participate. And to be honest, I don't think this is anything immoral about it. If I think, you know, this is a good book and I want a friend of mine to know about it, he gets an email, the response rates are 30 to 40% to those emails. So it's not considered as spam. I want to give you some other examples here of social networks. Who of you is a member of OpenBC? So the majority of people. Here's an example that OpenBC allows you to check out people who have recently visited your contact page. So, to be honest, I don't know a single one of these people who I just looked at today. Never heard of any of them. But it's interesting that it even shows you the way how they found me on OpenBC. So you can't check out somebody incognito. They know that you looked at them. Interesting. It again shows you something about the social networks and about the interests, the intentions of people. It's also possible if, let's say, a publicly traded company suddenly has much more activity from its members on OpenBC, that you might be able to draw some inference about what might be happening at the next earnings announcement of that company. So just by people's behavior, you can aggregate it up and come up with models of what might be happening. Here's another example, a screenshot I just took this morning of a company called Technorati, which monitors the 50 million blogs that are in the world. And what I looked here is, I wanted to know who is linking in their blog to Weigand.com. And it actually turns out that the top blog is from 8 days ago of some person who, again, I don't know, who's talking about me in his blog. So Weigand.com is not relevant. But if you think about BMW, if you think about Bertelsmann, it might be very interesting to understand what are people talking about and, in the worst case, do damage control if something bad is happening, particularly if it's not true what's being talked about. Here's one more example of how we leverage data, and that's called social search. Social search actually means a number of things. I've heard, and I don't know whether it's true, that 30% of Yahoo's page views are Yahoo Answers, which is not going to pages on the internet, but people typing in a question and then other people, unpaid, answering that question. So what is certainly the fact is that Yahoo Answers has been grown dramatically in these 8-9 months since its inception. So Yahoo Answers means I can post the question to the world via Yahoo and some random person will give me some random answer and I don't really know whether I can trust them or not. This company, in contrast here, Illumio, has a very different model of understanding who one should ask. You install a client on your laptop, on your computer, or within the internet, and that client indexes your entire hard drive. So it knows about every single file you have, about every single email you have, about every single contact you have. But it's not telling anybody what's in your hard drive, so don't worry about it. No panic attacks here. It stays on your hard drive. It just builds an index. But what's happening is, when somebody in the world has a question, like this gentleman who wanted to know about search engine logic, about so-called statistically improbable phrases, that question gets farmed out to all the Illumio users, or if it's within your corporate network, to everybody within your company. And then your little agent says, only to you, it doesn't tell it anybody else, say, I think, Andreas, you know the answer to that question because I found a few files on your disk which has statistically improbable phrases on them. And it turned out that I worked on that when I was at Amazon, and indeed, that person here got a quick answer back from me. So think about how extremely targeted now questions arrive at people's places. And why? Because the technology exists which allows us to do this in a very clean way. Right now, it's not monetized, but I invite you to think about how monetization of this would work. Finally, just less than everything, it's also showing in the products. Here is an example of books at Amazon.com based on people bought X or support Y. And this is a relatively well-known graph, which I got from Valdis Krebs, not my own work, which says on the right-hand side, you have books like, "What's so great about America? Why we fight?" and stuff like this. And the left-hand side, you have Noam Chomsky's Manufacturing Consent, etc. And these more Democrat books and the more Republican books are just linked by one book. What went wrong? In the remaining 10 minutes, I want to draw the link back to what we started with in the very first lecture here, where we learned about the long tail. And this is the graph from the original paper by Chris Anderson from Wired magazine from 2 years ago by now. And I want to, in closing here, talk about what architectures of participation actually do to the long tail. On the first day, yesterday, we only learned that we can discover in the long tail, for example, by following recommendation engines. So that means that this demand curve gets flatter because people can find more stuff here in the tail of the distribution. But let's now consider peer production, or let's consider consumer-created content, or at least the consumer-distributed content. Because those 30, 40,000 items uploaded on YouTube every day are not all originals. In many cases, they actually are just consumer-distributed content. So what happens is that the tail of the distribution gets more and more populated. Because people are not producing the head of the distribution, the hit-driven economy, but people are producing in the tail of the distribution. So the interesting thing is that both the discovery, which was described yesterday, and the architects of participation point in the same direction in flattening out the demand curve. If you ever look at any of these graphs, I would bet you that plotting them on a logarithmic x-axis and a logarithmic y-axis, you will find straight lines. This one is here from Amazon.com, the distribution of number of reviews received for an item. So for some items here, there were, like for Harry Potter, after 3 months, 3,800 reviews. I don't know why people are writing the 3,801st review for a book like Harry Potter, but they do. On the other hand, 500,000 items only received a single review. So the hallmark of any consumer-contributed content is this, what's called a power law, a straight line on a log-log plot. It's characterized by its slope. Equally well, if you want to know how much do people produce, most people only write one review, but some reviewers are really prolific. Again, a power law. When you build a website, when you're interested in finding out what people are thinking, think about simple things. For example, at Amazon.com, we had at the bottom of each page a little comment box, which is clearly messaged as, don't expect an answer on this. Just if you feel like contributing, do contribute and tell us what's wrong with the page. So for example, here, the person might say the page takes too long to load, and then they enter their comment, and they hit return, and it goes into some queue. It's a few hundred to 1,000 reviews a day they receive. Another example is Yellow Pages. Local content is an $80, $90 billion market. Amazon had cars driving through the cities and taking pictures. But of course, you can't pay people for checking out with picture, might be the best picture for that Costco here on 10th Street in San Francisco. So you leave it up to people. Well, maybe it's that picture which is better. Or maybe it's this one. No, that's a Coca-Cola truck. So, well, let's stay with this one. And the question of monetization. Of course, monetization goes via some measurable result. In this case, it is click to call, if you want to click to call the business. I've one more example here where attention the other way can be traded off against money. And we heard about this yesterday briefly, the launch of Spiral Frog, which is going to be launched by Universal in about December this year, where instead of paying 99 cents for a song, you pay for the song with your attention. Now, the one thing which I missed in those 2 days is comments about Generation G, about the gamers. We all know that TV times, etc., are going down, and that for the 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18 year olds, gaming is one of the most time consuming activities. So when we talk about marketing and advertising, there's lots of work happening for in-game product placement. Here, for example, in Sims 2, people can find certain colors for their eyebrows, etc., and that's used to then down the road make predictions on what will be selling well that season. Or another example here, in-game billboards, it depends on your gender, whether you see this ad, or maybe whether you see that ad, this ad, or that ad in the game. So there's a lot of space where you can use people's attention. And I want to close with this final slide here. This slide came out of the conversation I had when we were preparing for the conference. And I've really appreciated that slide because it gave us a framework to understand the traditional, more traditional marketing approaches, more push, with what might be a more future marketing approach of more for pull. So traditionally, the consumer was a passive acceptor, a person who had pushed contact to him. Whereas in the Web 2.0 economy, if you will, the consumer has become an active contributor. The examples I gave you was on Flickr, where they put up pictures, which they tag, and another bunch of examples. Product development used to be based on offline on the company's competencies. Now, in this architecture of participation, we measure what people want, and the example I gave you here was just for a simple website, Amazon.com, where the consumers vote with their mouse clicks which product they like better, whether they like it better on the left-hand side or the right-hand side. Mass markets used to be served with mass-produced products. On the other hand, we have fragmented market, small markets, and interesting companies, for instance, a company called Zazzle in Palo Alto, which Z-A-Z-Z-L-E, which producing arbitrarily small amounts of things on printers, three-dimensional printers. The feedback from consumers used to be happening on a long time scale, and only very few people ever really bother writing in if they're not happy about something. In contrast, feedback through the communication we live in has become trivially easy. You can measure it either explicitly by asking them for feedback, as I did with this consumer comment box at Amazon.com, or we can get it implicitly by offering different versions. And finally, it's the difference between stated preferences on the left-hand side and revealed preferences on the right-hand side. So I still have about 1 minute left and would like to invite you to ask any questions you have.
Thank you very much, Andreas.
Thank you.
I must say I have not seen log chart for 17 or 18 years. I worked through them at my BCG times. I put together a lot of them, and I hated them at that time because it's a lot of work to do it. Now it's done with a machine. I'm not sure whether everybody understood it because people are not used to deal with these kind of charts, what it exactly means. I found one thing which I found between lots of others, very interesting, because it's directly important for our business, that you said the prediction which you get from past behavior was less predictive at the end than, let's say, what the way where a person in the actual situation came from through the net, or the mood or the timing. I think that was quite interesting. I would have seen it differently, but my expectation would have been differently. I think that is very interesting. And it leaves, for me at least, also always questions about all these data, let's say, what we leave. You said, what was it, breadcrumbs, woman, which you leave somewhere in the internet and which you can trace better and better, let's say. And I think this is a very transparent world, or the network. I think that was a very interesting thought for me, which I had not gone through in that much detail. Are there comments, questions to Andreas? If not, thank you very much, Andreas, for coming here, giving us this speech. We will meet again in 11:15 and go for then the second half of the morning. Thank you very much.
Vielen Dank.
Lock, das war so eine Leute, am Ende war es, wie ist das?